It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 96.
Rewriting the inscriptions on all the ancient monuments of the world because they're all mistranslations of the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
We have with us today Sherwood Smith. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, you are the author of Banner of the Dam, which came out, if I recall correctly, on the 3rd of April.
Correct.
And people will recognize it because it's A, got a beautiful cover, and B, it's a very large book. But that's because there's a lot of awesome that's packed in between its covers. It also smells nice.
Yeah, I did ask Daw to insert the smell-o-rama package.
Fantastic. Well, I love it. So
the nice thing about the smell-o-rama package in this book is that at least you know that everybody is clean because they have magic to help them out with things like that.
Yep.
This is true.
So, other medieval fantasies wouldn't be so nice.
No, Game of Thrones, I don't think a lot of people shower.
Well, this one isn't really medieval. It's more pre-industrial.
Right.
Yeah.
When I hear medieval, I think of specific things, certain paradigm, both political and religious, and mine does not fit either of those paradigms, although it's closer to the political.
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So,
although Marlowe and Hesia to me seems more medieval than, say, the Sartora. Is it Sartora?
Sartor is a at that period, it's a very loose empire. Austro-Hungarian empire of, say, from 1450 up to 1806 when Napoleon invaded and it ended.
That makes much more sense then. And then Kalendi is more like, to me, it sounded very French in all of its...
Well,
swagly.
Let's see. Holland, I guess if you want to compare it to any of our cultures... It would be a combination of Heian Japan, a little bit of Chinese post-Mogul, and French.
That gives me a different take on things. Thank you.
Somebody knows their
silly
history.
Period.
Right.
This is the height of their silly period.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way so that I could laugh at them even more than I already was.
So to start off, the kind of basic question, since you've never been here before and we get to legally ask you this question until you show up again and then we can't ask it ever again, which is, what drew you to writing and why fantasy and not, I don't know, travel narratives to South America?
I started writing when I was, I started making books out of paper towels when I was 6 years old, but I started getting really serious about it when I was 8, when I started writing about this world. The original impetus was, it's the same year I became, a reader. In third grade, they finally let us go to the school library. And because I was daydreaming through the long, boring introduction, I missed the fact that you could check out books for 2 weeks. I thought you had to bring them back the next day. So for quite a time, I was religiously bringing back a book, you know, reading a book a day and bringing it back. And by the time I found out you could check it out for longer, you could only take one out at a time in third grade. I decided later for that, I was reading a book a day. A habit that stayed with me for life. But I began to notice that the adventures were mostly about boys, and the girls were either, we know all that, I don't have to go into it. I was already seeing these things in my mind, had been since I was a kid. I was going to write these stories down about girls who had adventures, a gang of girls my age, on this other world. And I began learning about the world as I wrote about them, and I've never stopped.
That's a good answer. So do you still have some of those books written on paper, on the old paper?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's only one existing paper towel one. My mother threw away all of the fantasy ones. You have to realize that this was the 50s, and conformity was important. And my family thought it very odd that I was into magic and all this other stuff. They wanted me to be normal. And so one time when I was 7, I remember sitting down to make this one. I felt like a fraud, but I felt like I needed to buy myself cred, you know, in 7-year-old terms. And so I made one called Friends, and I made it the most normal little storybook possible. Really boring kids. All the girls had short hair because all my girls had long hair. They were all playing sports and jumping rope, and nobody was flying. I had lots of flying children in my stories. And that was the only one that got saved. I still have it.
Oh, that's sad.
Well, it's an artifact of the times. It's, you know, my parents were not monsters. They wanted the best for us, and they were very young. My mother was 18 when I was born. They were trying to learn parenting. Both of them had come from broken homes. I should not get into personal stuff. It's not fair to talk about people who cannot, you know, talk themselves. But anyway, the fact is, during the 50s, conformity was important.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense. I was just researching recently the McCarthy era and McCarthyism. And there was a lot of that kind of just in terms of, you know, you had to conform even just to the very specific version of American culture, because was such a fear, like, oh my gosh, you could be a commie if you don't quite agree with the rest of us.
That's right. It was miserable for minorities, and we could see it at school, and we even participated in it.
What was interesting is that it really that continued, at least that the fear of magic even continued up until when I was a kid in the 80s. And parents were still very concerned about what effect fantasy would have on their children. And
yeah.
I had friends who weren't allowed to read it. And, you know, Dungeons and Dragons was definitely the devil's work. And so you couldn't play that, you know, and that was still an influence on me and my childhood.
I remember seeing and being concerned about that. In fact, participated in something that Jane Yolen organized in the 80s. But this was a different issue. It was more, I did have a schizophrenic uncle, and I think my parents were afraid I was going in that direction. The fantasy stuff was, it wasn't that they were worried about, there was no such thing as Dungeons and Dragons in there.
Right.
Those days. I think that they were afraid that I was, especially since I'd sit there daydreaming and I'd look like him when he was listening to the static between radio stations and hearing voices telling him to go slash the neighbor's tires.
Right.
So, you know, when I look back and think about that, I cut my parents a lot of slack. They backed off when I was a teenager after a couple of, you know, mildly confrontational episodes, which devastated me, and they backed off and never interfered again.
That's interesting. And then you, of course, went on to write more stories, presumably about similar characters. And those are, you know, make up a large portion, I assume, of your YA. Correct me if
I'm
wrong.
Well, yeah. The Wren books were my attempt to make a light, a version of my world that publishers would agree to. On my world, kids didn't have to grow up. What it actually meant was they didn't have to attain puberty. They would still age. But there were if they went to Earth, they could come back to the world and stay there. There was no such thing as the ending that I hated, where Earth children would go to the world and come back and be content to give up fantasy and conform or forget it all. Hated those two endings. Hated them with a passion.
Right.
But I knew that I was 13 when a friend told me that, writers are not gods on Mount Olympus. They're actually human beings. We could be published someday. And I thought, whoa. Then I thought, you know, they're never going to publish my kind of stuff because it breaks their rules. And I already knew the rules from reading a book a day for years.
So when did you start writing about the Sartorius world?
When I was 8.
When you end this. And then how about the YA that you later published for it, though?
Yeah, those were the ones that I have published were all written when I was a teenager.
That's interesting. Okay.
You've been at this a long time.
Yeah. I'm 60 and I started when I was 8, so do the math.
So how much do those YA stories play into The Banner of the Damned?
A lot. If anybody has read one called Senrid, which I wrote when I was 15, they would know the ending of Banner of the Damned.
I knew we'd see them later. Or earlier, as the case may be. I was wondering, because it seemed like, you know, like such a perfect opening for another book in the series, so to speak. But if it's already dealt with, then that makes it even more intriguing. That's interesting. It's an interesting way to approach, you know, like a timeline. This is kind of out of time and yet very much within it as well.
Yes.
Because it's taking place 400 years after the Inda series, which isn't quite YA, but still about a young adult. But it's very much steeped in the history and the setting, and there's historical references left and right that people who haven't read the previous books will be like, oh my goodness, you know, what is she talking about, to an extent? But they all kind of layer the background and give you much more rich understanding of what's going on within the story. Did you do that? I mean, why take it that far out of time?
Well, I didn't really intend to. The problem was, when you're writing over your lifetime, you're also developing your craft. And the stories are all built on those early ones. I can't change them. I think of it as a house of cards. If I pull out a card at the bottom that I've decided I don't like, then everything comes tumbling down. So it's all interconnected. And as I got older, I began to understand why things were the way they were and to write about them. And that included reaching back in their history. So I knew the general outline of the Inda story, which, by the way, it's not young adult. It starts when they're young, but it ends up when they're all married to have kids.
Right.
In the last one. In fact, they're middle-aged, close to middle-aged at the end of the last one. But anyway, I first saw the vague outline of that one when I was 16, but I was not able to write it for another several decades.
Why?
It was too big a story. I couldn't handle it. I didn't understand enough about, well, ship tactics. I had to do years of research to understand ships, really understand navigation, ship tactics, and strategy when you don't have gunpowder. And to understand geography and how geography plays into culture. And then, of course, learning about human nature and where does the impetus to fight come from? And can we edit that out of ourselves? You can explore all that stuff through fiction. And the thing about Another World is, I think, coming back to your question about fantasy, is that it's a kind of a safety zone or a sandbox to play out your ideas for people. If I write those things about, if I make fiction about us in our time, and people do very successfully, and I read it and enjoy it, it seems to me that you also have to fight the political battles. Readers bring to work their own life experience, their own expectations. And that's good. So each book is different for each reader. However, sometimes people will bring their hot buttons and read something into the work that you did not put there. And I think there's more of a chance of that if we're writing about our real politics and so forth. And then, of course, there's just escapism. I love castles and fighting, flying and magic and cloaks and all that stuff. So, yeah, I'm going to keep writing about it. I'm never not going to like that stuff. People told me when I was younger, you'll grow out of it. Hasn't happened.
Didn't happen for me either. I love castles, too.
But even though Banner of the Dam, definitely, it has the magic, it has the castles, it has everything else that you would want in just a sort of escapist, except maybe dragons. I don't think we saw any dragons. Right, they're hiding somewhere. it's a pretty complex political system, or at least social system. Sean has a question later about the sexuality and everything like that. So this is not quite escapist literature at all.
Well, it's escapist in the sense that it does not impact. I try to make books that will make people feel good when they finish it, or at least thoughtful. I don't want to write books that make you feel like going out and hanging yourself. Although, again, you can't control reader reactions. So maybe if somebody will go, oh, God, 750 pages of this, I'm hanging myself.
Stina Likes does that. Books are so depressing.
Yeah. people do that well, give you that catharsis.
Right. That makes sense. Sean, go ahead to your question.
Oh, about sexuality?
No. You can go to just the next question if you'd like.
Okay. There. Just a warning. There's somebody decided they wanted a weed eat.
Sorry.
Jerks. They did it earlier, too, and now they're going to do it now when I'm recording. They're mean.
But I can't hear it, so you're okay.
We're good for now. Well, actually, one of the things because Jen was going to ask you about YA, and she sort of brought this up, but I kind of wanted to question whether or not, because this book is marketed as an adult book, but I would almost call it a Bildungsroman.
Okay.
For the German terms for coming-of-age stories, for those who don't know the term. Because I think that, yes, Jen was saying that there was a lot that is about, there's an adult in complexity-ness, I guess, about it, which I wondered, because so much of this book is about Emrah's sort of growing into herself, even though we don't get a lot of her early childhood, we get it in sort of flashbacks and snippets, but a lot of this is about her growing up into herself. So I'm really curious, from your perspective, what do you see is YA literature and what is not YA literature? I guess is where I'm trying to get at.
Okay, that's a good point about Bildungsroman. I guess I did do that, and with the first Inde book, start with them as children and then watch them grow and see what shaped them. But yes, it's not for children. YA, I think it's better to define it broadly because there are so many types of young adult literature. It's a form that is still defining itself as our culture is still defining itself and exploding, and we're really in the middle of a golden age. There are wonderful books coming out now. But I see it mainly as books from the teenage point of view. Usually they're about young people, although they can sometimes be about adults. But it's the perspective of a young person and a young person learning about the world and learning to deal with the world and themselves in the world and other people in the world. Whereas an adult book, you're already in the world. You already know the world. And so you have your place in it. You might not be happy with that place and you're going to deal with it. But it's just a difference in long-term perspective.
But so, in your opinion, though, Emrys is more of that latter than the former,
yes.
Because she does seem to be finding her place. I mean, in a sense, she knows exactly where she is. She's a scribe, and she has her three rules. But at the same time, she struggles with those rules and the application of them throughout the book, although not quite on a conscious level.
Right.
It becomes later a moral crisis for her. How do you see that as different from what, a teenager does, which is kind of, to me, the same thing, that yes, they don't know their place. They're kind of finding their place. But that's still, to me, what Emrys is doing, just not on a conscious level.
Yeah. Let's see if I'm understanding. If this were a YA book, I would have ended it when Emrys was appointed the princess's
scribe.
Yes, because she would have attained her goal. She would have found her place in life, and it probably would have started when she was 10 years old and went to the scribe school.
Right.
Because it would have been about kid interactions. We would have learned more about the other kids in the classes, who was weeded out, the interdynamics of the kids. And we get a little bit of that. But Emrys as an adult is showing how her adulthood was shaped when she gives us little glimpses of her interactions with the kids an adult's point of view.
Right. I think that was one of the things that I found really interesting about Emrys, though, is that she does start at that young age, and I was just saying to Sean right before we got you on that in a lot of ways she seems very timeless and ageless. I don't know if it's because of her sexuality, because she never goes through that sort of pubescent blossoming of sorts, and it's not until later that she really examines the repercussions of, you know, where she has been and what she has done. And by the end of the book, that though a number of years has passed, she still in a lot of senses has that a somewhat juvenile mind. At least that was my impression of her, which I found really interesting.
Yeah, it's, me, outside of the story, I finally got a key to Emrys when I realized that I was playing with levels of narration. And what I was working with here was a narrator who absolutely believed that she was a reliable narrator, but who isn't.
Right.
She is unreliable, but she doesn't know it. So what I'm picturing is somebody who's 40 years old and sitting in a cell, uninterrupted, writing about her life. In a sense, it's going to seem timeless because the insights are at that time, and she's picking and choosing the incidents that make sense at that time.
Hmm.
So we don't know what the old Emrys is going to be like. We don't know what the 60-year-old Emrys or the 80-year-old Emrys is going to be like. It's her at that time.
That's interesting, because it does make you wonder, you know, what would this story have been like if she were 10 years older, or if she were 10 years younger, or 20 years older or younger, how her perspective might have changed on these events. I think that's a really interesting thing to think about.
And I'm glad you brought up the levels of narration, because one of my later questions, and yes, I'm totally skipping most of your questions, Sean, but it's pertinent right now, is the fact that the deer is, or dur, is almost cheating. If you know, but that it's letting you explore the perspective of characters that you would otherwise never have gotten, because this is a first person narrative. But you were, I mean, I'm glad you said you were playing with those levels of narration and perspective and everything else. And it was interesting seeing her step into the different characters at two different places. Earlier in the book, it's just kind of seamlessly thrown in. You don't know about the deer's existence. You don't know how it's possible. She just says that it was. But then later, when it's more of a present tense experience, her perspective in those shifts even changes a little bit.
Yeah.
Phone, sorry. Well,
that's okay. I've got my phone here. In case it rings, I can turn it off real fast. Did she go out?
Oh, she may have an important phone call.
Yeah.
That may have been. She's been having.
No, sorry. It wasn't an important phone call. It was my stupid house phone ringing and driving me insane, and it wasn't going to go off. And I forgot that the ringer was even on. It's normally off. We only have cell phones anymore. So the fact that it was on is like, gah! And all I get are junk calls, and they just sit there and ring at me over and over again. It's very frustrating. Anyway, I'm sorry. I was trying to say, go ahead, answer the question, I'll be right back, but I was too busy turning my microphone off as I dropped my headphones to run across the room. Okay. Where were we?
Talking about the dire. It's there, it's actually being introduced, because it's a major theme or thing, player aspect of the stories to come.
That makes sense. And I thought
stories to come. Ooh, exciting.
I did find that really interesting. And Jen had brought up earlier the Emrys' struggle with the laws of the scribes, and particularly the first two laws, which is on the first page, so I'm not ruining anything for anybody. Like, that lays the laws out right quick.
It's even on the jacket.
Oh, well, see, even there. So, okay. But the first two laws are don't interfere and keep the peace. And it's very interesting, because with the dire, this seems like this really conflicts with those laws, and that this part of her struggle throughout the book with, you know, how far do I push, you know, how much do I take counsel with the princess, or how much do I talk with my friend who works at the bookshop, or, you know, this constant struggle with at what point do you violate the law? And I really was fascinated by that sort of rigid system.
Yeah, I try to indicate that they're constantly reinventing it, and that in fact their do not interfere is impossible.
Right.
But it but it acts as a break. It's a legal fiction that both parties agree to, because the political problem is you want smart people around you, but you don't want them so smart they take over.
Yeah. Well, it runs into the problem, too, is interference is quite literally impossible for a scribe to do, precisely because what a scribe does, I mean, anything a scribe puts down on paper could be an interference. I mean, just the way you write history.
Correct.
Or even the third law, you know, tell the truth as we see it. Well, what does that even mean?
Yes.
Well, and even you can't keep the peace without potentially interfering anyway.
Yep.
So they're definitely a little bit more complex than they seem to be, just as being called the three rules, you know?
That's right.
If only things were so simple.
Well, it's sort of like, you know, I don't know if you had intended it to be a play on Asimov's three rules of robotics, but those rules eventually break down too. And so if you follow the mythos of Asimov's robot series, he actually has to add new rules into it in order to make the previous three rules work. And I don't know if that's something you had intended to do by creating the three rules, but it is interesting that, you know, you come up with these reductive three rules, but, well, those are completely untenable in any realistic culture, and so they break down eventually.
Yeah, I was not. That's an interesting point, and I did read Asimov as a teenager, but it was not a conscious homage. I think it was what was in my mind was the general, like you said, the fact that people will set out to give themselves a number of specific rules to operate by or live by. But obeying them, interpreting them, and obeying them is another subject entirely.
Yeah.
As evidenced by our own Constitution.
Yes, yes, yes. Or the Ten Commandments in the
Mishnah.
Or the
Ten Commandments, right, yes.
Well, I mean,
rules are very much steeped in this, the moment in which they're being examined.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the Ten Commandments one is interesting, you know, thou shalt not kill. But then we create all of these, well, this is not technically killing, so it doesn't count as the command, you know, like
yep,
these
yep.
kinds of ways of kind of getting around what are rigid rules, which we understand don't actually work in a realistic setting. And I just had fun with that. I just thought, like, every time I was reading, I was going, you shouldn't do that. You're going to violate the rule. So I would, I guess, be a pretty terrible lawyer in this world if they had lawyers.
They have advocates.
Sounds just as seedy.
It depends on you know where you are, which country, and so forth. But anyway.
Yeah. So switching gear. Jenna brought up that I wanted to talk about sexuality, and I was really interested in how sexuality is represented in this book because for two reasons, and one will be for a second question. The first is really you set up in this setting, this old world, older world setting, very clear dynamics of sexuality. It's not just like everything's heteronormative. No, there's in fact the culture has adapted to say, well, no, there are some people that just like people of the same sex, some people that like opposite sex, some people that don't even like either. And I think there are other situations as well. And I was really interested, what was your impulse for, or what was your rationale or desire to sort of have this world be, I guess, multisexual?
That's interesting. Nobody has ever asked me that before.
Thank you.
But it's such a big thing.
Either I get hammered for being immoral or other people, you know, say, oh, yeah, I really like this. It depends. Obviously, we're back to, you know, readers and bringing their own life experience and what they want, how they guide their own lives to.
Right.
You know, I don't want to hammer anybody with any type of a tradition. But, okay, going back to my thing, when I was a teenager and became aware of sex, and, of course, I was – you know, attracted to boys. I thought at first that there were no gay characters. And within a few, very few years, I realized I got it wrong. There were gay characters because when I write these things, I don't invent characters. They come into my mind. They're fully formed. I know it sounds woo-woo and stupid, but that's my process. And when I see somebody is interested in somebody else, oop, exception. And remember, I was a teenager, and I'm trying to learn about the world, and I'm getting hammered by, you know, mid-60s aura and whatever. And I finally realized that, no, there's all kinds of choices, but nobody cares. So as I got older, I thought, well, why does it work this way? Why does it work here? Nobody's going to believe it if I don't. And I kept looking back and back at their history. And what I finally came up with was the fact that when humans came through the world gate, originally, they came through in three different sets. There was a ship, Portuguese slave ship. They settled on one continent. And there was a Viking exploratory expedition. And then there were Chinese. They were the earliest, actually. the indigenous life forms were appalled by these filthy creatures who spawned and dirtied up everything and murdered each other, murdered their children. They finally figured out a way to communicate and said, basically, if you don't clean up your act, we're getting rid of you all. Now, the first people they communicated with were women, because women, they're water people. There are all kinds of indigenous life forms, but this particular set are water people. They took form in order to talk to women washing clothes by the riverside. So women got magic first, and that immediately gave them gender balance with the men, who, you know, as we know in history, have the stronger arm and the weapons have been in their hands. Women had magic first, and they were the ones who realized that they had to clean up the act. So what they did first was use magic to make life better, make life cleaner. And that's what people want when they get to a new place. They want to establish a comfortable home. So it makes sense that magic would be used to clean the water, to keep homes from tumbling down when you build it, you know, that kind of stuff. Also, the women, as they gained in power, started using magic to weed out the sexual predators.
Ooh.
So they did. There was a genocide program for a long time, and it's hidden. It's hinted at in a few of the stories, because now, of course, they're completely ashamed of it. But in those early days, we're talking about a couple of within a generation or two of medieval and before ship people coming over. So they had their own paradigm of that time, human paradigm. But I tried to extrapolate what would happen if people had magic and they could fix the things that make life tough.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, these women, so my supposition was that they pretty much weeded out the genetic disposition to prey on children. So there are no pedophiles, and rape went away because they figured out birth control, for instance. You can only have a child if you want to.
Right.
So if those two things become part of the general cultures, then a lot of the darker side of sexuality goes away. Not everything, because human nature is still human nature, but an awful lot of it would go away, particularly over the centuries. And so if you can accept that, then I think you can accept the fact that somebody's gay, who cares? Somebody's bi, who cares? If they're poly, then they have to work out who's going to raise the children and who's going to inherit, because a lot of these things are about property too.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody cares. And if you decide you really aren't into sex, nobody cares. It's just not interesting.
Yeah, and that makes sense in the world too, with the pleasure houses, that there's no shame impulse, I guess you'd say, in this world. That in fact, a lot of the characters suggest to Emrys, who is asexual, in her early stages in the book specifically, that they did take her to the pleasure house and they give her her first experience, and she's not interested, but all of her friends basically go to the pleasure house and do what I'm assuming most people do in a pleasure house, but and I'm just really fascinated by this whole the way that sexuality is presented. And now that you've given me this like history lesson, that's even more fascinating now. Just the level of detail you've gone into this world is kind of mind blowing.
Well, in our own history, we've had cultures where fathers would take their sons and get them their first lay, you know, when they were ready, when they showed an interest. So I figured in my culture, well, why can't the women do that? So yeah, when teenagers are ready for it, they're given this opportunity, or they find their way to it themselves. With the pleasure houses, I figure it can get complicated. There are people who don't want to marry somebody who's had a lot of experience. And I think some of that comes into, well, are they going to think that I'm not good enough? You know, people are people. So, and relationships are relationships. But there is no shame. And pleasure houses are often the seats of culture. You go there to hear music, go there to play cards, you go there to see a play. And if you want to go upstairs and have sex, then, you know, you pay for a professional, tell them what you like, and take your pick.
Actually, reminds me a bit of the Jacqueline Carey series, the Nama's Kiss, Kushiel. I think it starts with Kushiel's Justice or something.
Yeah.
Kushiel's Scion, in which pleasure houses.
Dart is the first one.
Dart, thank you. Yeah. In which pleasure houses obviously play a big role, and sexuality is kind of, you know, it's an acceptable thing to most of the characters, not all the characters, but she still has the darkness to deal with. And so it makes more sense now that you said that you essentially, they took the darkness out of sexuality. And I mean, like you said, though, a lot of that has more to me to do with the fact that birth is so easily controlled. So, and they're not dealing with things like, you know, large amounts of famine or drought. So, you know, it doesn't become quite so much of an imperative to have the heteronormative relationships. And if the laws are written in that are conducive to not having heteronormative relationships, then that takes a lot of the power play out of sexuality.
Yes.
Which I think is very nicely reflected in Banner of the Damned, and presumably some of the other books. But the why do I keep forgetting the name of this? I'm sorry. This cold is killing me.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that was a real thing, what you just said.
It totally was a real thing. The Kalendi.
Oh, the Kalendi, yes.
Yeah, I mean, yes. It's definitely, that's where it's prevalent. You see much more heteronormative relationships in Marlowe and Hesia, though, and they mention the pleasure houses, and they mention the non-heteronormative relationships, but it seems still that you generally have a man and a woman in the positions of power.
Yes. Yeah. The gender parity is important. They finally found that balance. And when they don't get it, they see that you know, begets problems. But that's the downside of power, is that you're expected that your public life is going to impinge on your private life. That is part of your responsibility.
Right. So they have to have heteronormative relationships just to be equal in society.
Yeah, a heteronormative marriage.
Marriage, yes.
Yeah, yes, and marriage means different things to different and different levels of society. And often, marriage is about property.
Right.
Yeah. And this kind of, well, this doesn't really transition into my second question, but I'm just going to transition into it anyway, which is how this relates to language. And now that you've given some of this history, which I had not been as familiar with, and some of the early settlers, it now makes some sense about how the different, I'm saying categories with quotes around it, of sexualities, and how those are represented in the language, and how they all derive from the same word, in the same way that you might get, for example, in Spanish languages, which have verbs which then conjugate, and they're all based on the same basic verb, but they conjugate out for the different meanings. And I thought this was interesting, because in the English-speaking world, which we are a part of, we have terms for the various sexualities, but they don't conjugate from a word. They all have sexual in them. You know, we've asexual, homosexual, heterosexual, metrosexual, I guess is one. you know, they all have sexual in them, but sexual means so many different things in very different contexts, that it's not really a conjugation. And I don't know where I'm going with this. I guess I'm curious what, was it the history that you had sort of written for this world that had made you consider having sexuality represented in the language in this way? Or was it that you wanted it so weaved into this world that it that there is that these distinct separations are maybe not as relevant?
Well, I'm assuming that this particular the particular sets of people I'm writing about, but Sartor is one of the oldest countries, and it's think of it a little bit like Latin, how much Latin has branched into all these different languages, Spanish, French, Portuguese, Italian, you know, et cetera, Romanian. Various languages have developed out of Sartoran. And so you have to go back, you know, they often go back and look at Sartoran roots, and that gives you cultural stability. There are others, of course, on the world, but that's this particular set, this book we're talking about, the cultures kind of go back to that. And I think, Koland evolved in such a way that they tend to label more things, particularly at this period. They do simplify after this. They go, you know, their cultures change. But they tend to delight in many, many labels for things. You get that, of course, with idiom and slang, and some of it eventually gets adapted in, stays around long enough to become words, and that's how vocabulary grows. And so I think what we're seeing here is the process of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that does make sense. I was trying to look up while you're saying that too, is trying to find the actual words so that I could see it.
Elor, eras, etc. Yeah, those are Kalendi words based on Sartoran.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious to find the quote from it too. It makes a lot of sense, and this is something that I guess. Maybe Jen and I, or maybe myself, just so focused on. And it's just one piece of a very, very complex story. Which I found it so fascinating. The second that you started making these, showing the terms and showing how sexuality is represented, I latched onto it. I was just so fascinated by that. So,
well, not just sexuality, but love. You know, the only two sets of words that I remember distinctly being discussed in Banner of the Damned are the words for love versus lust versus, you know, a casual relationship and serious relationship. And then obviously the terms for the different types of sexuality. You don't discuss many of the other words, although obviously the people of Kolin seemed a bit like Eskimos, in which they have 40 words for snow.
Yeah.
They like language. They like the ability to be very specific and yet very vague at the same time, you know, because it allows them to use language and style and everything else as part of their cultural control base, and which I thought was amazingly well done, by the way, describing that fashion, how the royalty of Kolind use fashion and style and everything else and even language and plays, what the most popular play is, to keep their people in line. It's like their cultural wars as opposed to wars with swords. That was a really interesting take on life and political structure. Did you just want to contrast that with like Marlowe and Hesia, or was that something that you really just found interesting to study as a political system?
Oh, I think it just derives more out of an interest in how cultures make their rules. Because the thing about social rules is that both parties have to agree to it.
Mm-hmm.
Politics doesn't exist. We all have to agree to it. We have to agree what a red light means, because otherwise it would just be blinking. We have to agree that we're going to stop here, and then when it changes, you know, we're going to go. The same with social rules. With these terms and so forth, I actually tried to limit it because it can be tiring for a reader to get too many of them. So, for instance, I didn't go into, because Emrys wouldn't, the fact that in Koland you can be Elor one day and Eros the next or whatever. You don't wear this label your entire life unless you turn out to be monogamous. And that makes it more playful and more fun. But for her, of course, she's just not interested in going there. So she gives you the basics and then moves on.
You had one more question, Jen, about magic, and I was trying to figure out a way to transition into that. But I think we should just give up about having good transitions.
Well, no, you know, exactly. This actually plays into the cultural aspect, this kind of society control and the rules. I mean, obviously, yeah. We talked a little about the scribes' three rules. But your magic system, but not so much the system, although the system is fairly structured, although you've done a great job of being both vague and specific with the magic system, so I can't actually tell you how it works. But the way that it's controlled and who gets to use magic, that is very specific. Unless you are taught within Sartor, you do not get to have magic. Or if you're royalty, you do not get to use magic. What do you see as the sort of repercussions of that type of control on your world? And why did you feel the need to approach it that way?
I was examining power and how we control power. And, of course, magic is going to change. For one thing, certain kinds of magic are slowly coming back into the world. There was a huge fight 4,000 years ago where most of it vanished. And certain aspects are coming back, and I'll get into that in further stories. But, yeah, the Magic Council in Sartor, thinking they control everything, not so much. But again, it puts a brake on things because there are consequences to all actions. And when we all agree on a law for general safety, as long as that law is functioning, we will obey it and we will uphold it. But as soon as we see that it's not working, we get rid of it and we step around it. So the Magic Council also goes through quite a number of changes.
Well, it would seem that they would be struggling with very similar rules to the one the scribes have. And
that's
obviously
right.
We know that those don't work. Yep. So they probably don't work any better for the Magic Council.
Yeah, I could have gotten into more. I really struggled hard to keep this to one book. If I'd explored all that stuff, it would have ended up being another, you know, four big long books, and I didn't want to do that. I want to get up to the modern times and the story arc there.
Ooh. Are they going to discover airplanes?
They don't need to.
Oh, that's true. It's fair. I'm just imagining, like, what would this world look like with steampunk and blimps? And But no.
There's a good science
fiction. They've already got transfer.
Yeah, exactly. They would never. I imagine they would have no impulse towards that.
No, not machinery. Yeah. Machinery has too many ugly byproducts.
Yeah, that's really interesting too. Is you don't see that a lot with where you get a fantasy novel where magic is like maybe not. I'm trying to get at this without necessarily speaking specifically to this book. Like you read a fantasy novel where everybody can just do magic, and like say Harry Potter. And yet, for some reason, they still need trains, and they're still playing around with cars, and all these sorts of things which make no sense in the context of a world where magic can do anything.
Well, yeah, the Harry Potter books are written for kids, and so kids are not going to care that you go to Hogwarts for all these years, and then you use magic basically to fight other magicians. That you're not fixing cancer, that you're not fixing pollution, that the Muggles are struggling on in their horrific lives, and you've gained all this power, and all you do with your power is fight other magicians, and maybe send notes to each other by owl. No, an adult looks at that and goes, yeah, right. But a kid, and these books are for kids, thinks, yeah, makes total sense to me.
Well, I mean, in that context, yeah, I mean, it is a kid's book, and, you know, a lot of kids' book. Like, it's not like somebody sat down with an astrophysicist and said, look, this is not going to work. Not, like, it doesn't. but you get that too to some extent with even adult fantasy sometimes, where magic exists, but yet there isn't seem to be an attempt to deal with, well, what does that actually mean for a culture?
That's right. It's mainly a weapon. They're throwing fireballs at each other.
Right. Or going to defeat the big evil bad guy who...
Yep.
The evil chosen one who's come from the depths and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, I mean, you should really think about it. And that's too, like, I've read some fantasy novels which, you know, they have a world with magic, and then suddenly they also have, like, coal and all of the, you know, things that are come through the industrial age and everything, and it makes me wonder, like, well, what is the point of this? Well, why does this still exist in a world where magic exists? In a sense that it's, even in Harry Potter, like, they kind of separate themselves from Muggle culture. But,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of rambling about something that maybe is not terribly relevant, but it is an interesting question, so.
Well, I think it depends on where the fantasy writer is coming from. Because, yeah, when I was younger, I used to get annoyed with books where the magic was entirely, you know, wizards with long beards hurling fireballs at monsters and so forth. Meanwhile, the peasants are living in their colorful hovels, you know, eating garbage at the base of the Dark Lord's castle. But on the other hand, that's the story that writer wanted to tell. So world building is not an issue for a lot of writers and readers. They don't want to hear about that stuff. They want to hear about the fireballs. That is entertaining to them. When they come home from designing ships or arguing a tough case in a courtroom or doing heart surgery, they want to read a book about a wizard throwing fireballs because that relaxes them. There is nothing to be said bad about that story. We're all doing different things with our books.
Well, that's true. No, and I don't want to disparage the genre and be like, I hate you all because you didn't think these questions through. I mean, I loved Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I got a kick out of it, and it was. It was escapist, and I just got into it.
Oh, I wish those books had come out when I was a kid. I just would have glommed onto them. I loved using them in the classroom when I was a teacher. Retired a few years ago, and it was so much fun when each book would come out in the summer, and I asked the kids in September, so who read the latest Harry Potter, and all the hands would go up, and I'd let them do book reports and so forth on it. Got very creative book reports back. That was awesome.
Yeah, it is. And that's the thing that I really loved about that too, is like, even though I loved the books, it was also to see how suddenly all of these kids who used to just want to sit around on their Game Boys or whatever it is they're playing on, those crazy kids, but then suddenly they're like, oh my gosh, I gotta get in line to buy a book. And it's like, you don't have to get in line. Amazon will send it to you. But it's like, no, I'm getting in line and I'm gonna dress up and I'm for a book.
Yep, that's right. The part of the fun was the parties at the bookstores. Gosh, that was so awesome.
Oh, nostalgia.
I wish I'd been a little bit younger.
I still spent all night, like, the day it came out. I ordered it from Amazon because I wanted it to be in my hands the day it came out, and I spent all night reading it.
Yeah, it was fun to think about the logistics behind that, hiring all these new people to take trucks full of Potter books around to land them on the doorsteps that day. It was kind of cool imagining that.
Yeah, and it's... there are people, oh my god, I have lots of weird stories of random stuff. I'm not gonna talk about it. We'll move on. I've got a bunch of very short random questions for you. So hopefully that this will be a first for us to try this, but I thought it'd be fun. So I'm gonna start with the first one, which is ink or graphite.
Ink.
Typed or handwritten?
Handwritten.
Ah, normal paper or recycled?
Oh, I guess the green me should say recycled, but part of me really loves good paper.
Ooh, that's a hard choice. You got to make a choice.
I'll be a good girl and say recycled.
Okay, one book you wish you had written?
Nah, that one doesn't work for me.
Oh, no. Okay, we will skip number four. We'll go to number five then, which is just a silly question, which is author you would vote for, whether that person's still alive or not, if he or she ran for political office.
Oh, wow. I guess I would have to ask which political office.
Well, he originally had president down, so we'll go with president.
All right. Who has the wisdom?
Oh, that's a good question.
To handle that, and who would not be corrupted by power, but has the gravitas to wrangle that herd of congressional beasties into line. And writer.
It's a tough one, huh?
Your silly question is the hardest one on this list.
It's true.
Not Machiavelli. He was able to stand back and look at politics as they were rather than as they should be. But he was not able to say, to redesign the system. And I'm looking for somebody. Spencer or Ariosto weren't there either.
Definitely not Swift.
You know, I'm leaning toward George Eliot. She had such an awareness of human nature and processes. I think I would go with George Eliot.
Awesome. All right, George Eliot it is. All right, I will not ever ask a question that hard for my silly question.
But it's a good question. It's a really interesting question.
We could get a very wide variety of answers for that question.
You just want me to keep asking it to everybody who's on the show now?
Because I think I'd answer Dr. Seuss, just for fun.
Wow! You know? Laughter is the great leveler, and if you crack up the Congress, you might be able to ram things through.
Exactly.
That's true. Maybe we need a comedian in office. Ooh. Who could go? Because it'd have to be a comedian that isn't too cynical, but also not too dirty.
Oh,
how about Rachel Maddow?
I don't.
She is a writer.
Congress going. I like Maddow, but man, I don't know. I think half of Congress hates her.
I don't know if I would subject her to that position.
Fair enough. Too. I do like Maddow quite a lot. I do find her very, very clever. And I do listen to her show, but I do think that, man, she would have a hard time with people that just don't like her.
Well, it's true, but we were talking about writers and comedians who voting for office, not how other people would handle her. And it's true, there would be a great deal of backlash for any of these.
That's true, especially Dr. Seuss. Come on, Jen.
That's true. There are a lot of people who did not like rhymes. That there would be an anti-rhyme movement.
Oh my goodness!
And obviously, he is, you know, brainwashing our children into being liberals. So,
Oh my god! Don't get started on that. I could not believe, like, what? It's just a movie.
Well, Sherwood is brainwashing people into believing that sexuality is a-okay no matter what type you have. So, I mean.
Yeah, what the heck? Come on now. teasing. Okay, so we got to get towards the closing out part, which is the sad part, and there will be tears. But it's okay. So this book, again, it just came out on the 3rd. But what else can people expect from you in the future? Like short stories? Do you have another novel in the works? Or are you going to be moonlighting at World Fantasy Con or something like that?
I go to a couple of conventions a year, but people can find out what I'm doing on my website. Type Google on Sherwood Smith and my website will pop up, and that includes books I have published and what I'm working on now.
Excellent.
Fantastic. So we'll make sure everybody goes there. I will put a link up and everybody go there. And everybody should get this book. It is really good. And it's very awesome. And I just would really recommend it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I had fun. And
I am so glad.
Every once in a while, I need a book that's like, you know, makes me think a lot, and I like that. So this is a book that made me think a lot.
Oh, super. Thank you.
You're welcome. Cool. So if anybody wants to contact us and to send us hate mail, which we will send anonymously to Sherwood, we won't actually do that. Just to be clear. We say this every episode, but really what we mean is send us your hate mail so that we can make fun of you in public for being so mean. Why would you send hate mail? But if you decide to do that and you want us to make fun of you, that'd be fun too. You can do that in a number of ways. You can go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
Blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
Twitter.
Twitter.com/SkiffyandFanty.
And then Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show.
Yep. Oh, you almost got her.
You almost got me on multiple occasions there.
Is there time for a question for you? A real
yes,
quick one?
Yes, of course.
Your names from James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake?
Wait, did we get our names?
Yes. Shanti, Jen, I thought, Finnegan's Wake. My goodness.
No. It's just his name's Sean and mine is Jen.
And we just
went from there.
Although that's really weird because I am in a Joyce class right now.
Well, it would come across jaunty and Sean. Oh, well, anyway, if you read Finnegan's Wake, you will see yourselves there.
Oh, boy. I'm really worried.
Now we have to go. Another book to read. Yay.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on our show, Sherwood. Would really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yay. Awesome. So we will see everybody next week. I don't know what we're doing. I mean, we're not professionals, so.
Never.
Yeah. So, bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.